This is Henry Zion, bringing you another story from my files here at the Missing Persons Bureau.
In these stories of the Missing Persons Bureau, dramatized for Henry Simon by Ross Napier, names and addresses have, for obvious reasons, been changed. In one moment, the search for Ronald Elliott, address unknown. And here again is Henry Simon.
In the past 10 years, much has been written concerning the rapid decline of the post-war generation. This stems largely, of course, from the increase in juvenile delinquency and the emergence of various youth cults, teddy boys and so on. The main questions that have arisen seem to be, firstly, how has this come about? And secondly, who is to blame? Numerous self-appointed spokesmen of the post-war generation place the responsibility fairly and squarely upon the shoulders of the parent generation. And the parent generation, in its turn, falls back on the war. My own view is that civilization itself is at fault, and that both generations are merely victims of its perversity. Such is the theme of the story which I'm about to relate. The story of a young man who was born with a chip on his shoulder, the weight of which proved almost too heavy to bear. It began on an October morning in the year 1956, when I was visited here in my office at the Missing Persons Bureau by a young woman who gave her name as Zelda McLean. She was 21 years of age, attractive in a tomboyish sort of way, with an intensity of expression and a wealth of youthful naivety.
We live in depressing times, Mr. Simon. Don't you agree?
Depressing? In what respect, exactly?
In every respect. We have no future.
Well, now, that's rather a sweeping statement to come from somebody of your tender years. But let's not involve ourselves in the discussion at this point, eh? My time is rather limited, you know.
Oh, yes, of course, I'm sorry. It's just that I'm so mixed up and, well, sort of preoccupied with myself and my thoughts, if you follow my meaning.
Yeah, quite, yes. Well, now, suppose you tell me just why you're here and what it's all about, eh?
It's about Ronald. He's disappeared.
Ronald?
Ronald Elliott, my fiancé.
I see, and you want us to find him, is that right?
Yes.
You realize, of course, their fees are quite considerable.
Oh, money's the least of my worries. I have all I want. And a good deal more.
You're very fortunate.
I won't be for much longer. Not if I marry Ronald.
No?
Daddy's threatened to cut off my allowance.
He doesn't approve of your choice.
Oh, he never has. He and Mummy both. They just don't understand Ronald. Not many people do. Because of what he is, they dislike him. You see, he's different.
In what way?
Well, he doesn't think as they do. He's the intellectual type.
Yes, I suspected he might be.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, nothing. Please go on.
To put it in a word, he's an existentialist.
An existentialist?
Yes.
I don't wish to appear ignorant, but I'm afraid I...
It means he's a sort of outsider.
Oh.
He doesn't believe in convention as we know it. He invents his own as he feels it should be, in accordance with his convictions and beliefs.
I see. How old is he?
22.
And you're officially engaged to be married?
Well, no, not officially. But we have an understanding.
How long have you known him?
For about 2 years.
And when did he disappear, exactly?
He's been gone a week.
Gone from where?
His lodgings. He has a room. Or rather, he had a room in Turnham Green.
He lived alone?
Yes.
His family, his parents?
He has nothing to do with them. They threw him out.
When?
Oh, 3 or 4 years ago, before I met him.
Why was this?
They just didn't get on.
Like your own parents, they failed to understand him, perhaps.
They weren't able to appreciate the complexity of his mind. He was above them, both socially and intellectually.
Hmm. Is he employed?
He's had dozens of different jobs over the years. Nothing that's ever suited him.
Was he working at the time of his disappearance?
No.
Was he fitted for any particular sort of profession or trade?
Well, no, not really. Although there's nothing he couldn't do if he wanted to. The point is, he has no specific ambition. He sees the world and humanity as a whole for what it is, and he wants no part of it.
That must be very awkward for him.
Oh, it is. But he's not alone. Everywhere, others like him are crying out for their rightful heritage, demanding that their cause should be recognized.
Cause?
Why should we suffer for the wrongs of our parents? Their wars are not our wars. As the youth of the nation, we are its strength, and our claims must be met. Freedom of thought and of action. Freedom
of... I take it you and Ronald are kindred souls.
Oh, but of course. I'm a part of him as he is of me. The cause has united us, and we raise our voices together in protest. A cry in the wilderness, Mr. Simon, yet soon it will be heard as the rumblings of an earthquake. For we are the conscience of the universe. We are its reformers, a generation apart from all those who've gone before us, whose bungling stupidity has brought the world to its knees.
Quite. Have you a photograph with you?
Photograph?
Of Elliot.
Oh, yes, in my handbag. Here.
Thank you.
It was taken in Hyde Park on a Sunday afternoon 2 or 3 months back.
I thought I recognized the scenery.
He was inspired that day. I've never heard him speak so well.
Speak so well to whom?
To his audience. He was addressing a gathering of young people.
Oh, a soapbox orator, eh?
Nothing of the kind. He had his own platform.
He spoke regularly?
Every second or third Sunday.
And when was the last time you saw him?
Last Tuesday evening. We had dinner in town.
How did he seem?
Oh, quiet. Rather subdued, I thought. We arranged to meet for lunch the next day, but he didn't show up. No, it wasn't the first time he missed an appointment, so I didn't think much about it. But when I didn't hear from him, I decided I'd better investigate. I went to his digs, and the woman who owns the place told me he'd gone. That was the Thursday. According to her, he left on the Wednesday morning.
For good?
That's what she said.
He didn't say where he was going?
No.
And you'd had dinner with him on the night before?
I was with him all the evening.
He gave you no indication of his intended departure?
None whatsoever.
Have you been in touch with his friends?
The few he has. They haven't seen him.
His parents?
Oh, they're the last people he'd confide in.
You've no idea at all where he might have gone?
Not the slightest.
There was no other woman in his life?
Certainly none that I know of.
Well, now, was he in financial trouble or anything of that nature?
If he needed money, he knew he could get it from me.
Have you given him any money in the past?
A bit.
You be a little more exact. How often and how much?
Well, a few pounds a week. Just enough for him to get by on.
In other words, you've been keeping him.
We've always looked on it as a sort of loan.
How long has this been going on?
Oh, about 18 months or so.
He must owe you quite a lot.
I've been more than repaid.
Oh?
By sharing his thoughts and dreams with me, his intellect... He's given me something I prize more than all the money in the world. Enlightenment, Mr. Simon. The power to lift myself above others and see things as they really are.
Hold it, Chief. Now hold it. Could I have that word again, syllable by syllable?
Existentialist.
Oh, brother, that one I got to jot down in my little black book for future reference.
I doubt we'll be called on to use it much in the course of normal conversation, study. Of course, it might be as well, as you say, for future reference.
Well, you never can tell. It's getting to be quite the vogue these days.
What is?
Thingamabobblism. I've been thinking of growing my hair and renting an attic and taking it up myself. Who knows? Maybe I might even graduate to a soapbox in Hyde Park. I could get Hunter to hand out the pamphlets, maybe even take up a collection at the end. You figure that his intellect would stand it?
Now, joking aside, you better have a word with the fellow's parents. They might have something to offer.
Oh, yeah.
I've got their address here somewhere. Oh, yes, yes, here it is. It's 57 Portland Road, Chalk Farm. At the Chalk Farm address, a neat semi-detached bungalow in a quiet, pleasant neighborhood, Study was greeted by our quarry's mother, Mrs. Lorna Elliott, a thin, tired-looking woman... estimated by the agent to be in her early 50s.
Well, that's the position as we know it now, Mrs. Elliott, and I was wondering if maybe you could fill in a few of the blank spaces for us.
As I've already explained, Mr. Study, neither I nor my husband has seen or heard from Ronald in over 3 years. Moreover, we have no desire to hear from him.
Why is that exactly, ma'am?
Because he's no good. He never was and he never will be.
Well, that's kind of a strange thing for a mother to say of her son.
He's not our real son. We adopted him when he was a child.
Oh?
I was unable to have children, you see. And my husband was anxious that he should have someone to survive him.
Uh-huh.
It didn't work. Hard as we tried, the boy simply wouldn't allow us to guide or advise him. For some reason, in spite of all we did for him, he seemed to resent us, even to despise us. We gave him the best education we could afford, lavished him with all the love and affection that was in us, and he repaid us by doing everything in his power to make our lives unbearable.
How was his record at school?
It couldn't have been much worse. He was expelled from 4 different schools in as many years. We finally had to take him away altogether. Then he refused to work. Simply wouldn't do a tap. For the best part of 3 years, he sat about the house doing absolutely nothing. Till in the end, my husband gave him the alternative of getting a job or clearing out. It was a dreadful scene. He called us both the worst names he could think of, and then packed his things and left.
And that's the guy who's going to reform the world, eh?
To be quite truthful, I think he's unbalanced.
Yeah?
He's always had the most peculiar ideas. Imagined everyone was against him, regardless of who they were or what they were. It was almost as if he looked on life itself as some fiendish plot devised solely that he might suffer.
Henry Simon returns to continue this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
Initially, I'd been in two minds as to whether or not I should undertake the case of the missing Ronald Elliot. Our client was obviously a highly impressionable young lady who had allowed her thinking to be dominated by a badly adjusted, rebellious upstart. Her plea, however, was a legitimate one, I decided. For not only did she consider herself betrothed to Elliot, but she'd also advanced him money in excess of £500. And so it was that Study resumed his inquiries at the lodging house in Turnham Green, where he interviewed one Flora Bucket, our quarry's former landlady.
So he's in trouble, is he? Oh, can't say I'm surprised.
Well, no, ma'am, there's no trouble. A friend of his is anxious to locate him, that's all.
Oh, it's no use coming to me. Like I said, he just left here. Not a word of where he was going or why. Up and off before he even had time to think of asking him. Oh, not that I would have bothered anyway. Too glad to see the last of him.
Oh, why?
He was odd, that's why. Screw loose. You only had to look at him to see that. Had the eyes of a wild animal.
But if that's the case, how come you took him in the first place?
Oh, I wasn't so particular then. I couldn't afford to be. Lodgers was hard to come by. But I swear there were times he fair put the wind up me.
How do you mean?
Well, the way he looked and things he said.
Such as?
There was no making sense of them, just words. Whenever I asked him what he was talking about, he'd laugh at me. You and me, Mrs. B, he'd say, we live in two different worlds.
What's so frightening about that?
It was the way he said it. Like he was some kind of being from another planet. I used to get his breakfast for him every morning, and from the time he sat down to the table to the time he got up again, he'd ramble on about how we was all headed for destruction. That kind of muck. And all them books he used to buy.
The books?
His room was so full of them, the door wouldn't open proper. Not ordinary books. Sort of, well, I don't know how you describe them. Most of them had titles about half a mile long. Weird stuff you couldn't make head nor tail of. I glanced through a few of them when I was cleaning out. Well, they might have been written in a foreign language for all I could make of them.
Where'd they come from, any idea?
He bought them.
New?
No, second-hand mostly. There's a little place down the street, Gully's. He was always in there, ferreting around. Never went in, but he didn't come out with his arms stacked full of them. Then he'd lock himself in his room and read for days on end without fudging. Sometimes his light was on through the night. Oh, talk about a bookworm.
When he left here, did he take them all with him?
No. Now, that's the strangest part of it. Before he went, he carted the lot downstairs and dumped them in the backyard. Oh, there must have been a couple of hundred.
Yeah?
Then, calm as you please, he put a match to them, made himself a bonfire.
After taking his leave of Mrs. Bucket, Study made his way to Gully's second-hand bookstore further along the street. It was a large shop, and like many of its kind, was dimly lit and musty. The shelves that lined the walls were piled high with books. Every available inch was taken up, from wall to wall, from floor to ceiling. Books, books, and more books. Everywhere. At the counter, Studdy spoke to the proprietor, Frederick Gully, a wizened old man who seemed as much a part of the shop as the books were.
Yes, Mr. Elliot, is one of our most regular customers. A deep-thinking young man.
You haven't seen him at all this week, I suppose.
No, not that I recall. But you'd best ask Mary, my assistant. She and Mr. Elliot are good friends. Doubtless she'd know.
Is she here now?
Unfortunately, I sent her on an errand. She should be back at any minute. If you'd care to take a seat, or perhaps you'd rather browse round the shelves. I'm sure you'll find we have an ample room.
Gully's assistant, Mary Duncan, who returned to the shop some 20 minutes later, proved to be a dark-haired, serious-looking girl with good features, marred somewhat by her sallow complexion.
No, Mr. Studdy, he hasn't been in this week, which is rather surprising, actually, because I've been expecting to hear from him.
Oh, yeah?
Well, he promised to let me know what the publishers thought of his book.
What book?
Oh, the one he's been writing. He finished it earlier this month, after 2 whole years. Oh, I do so hope it's a success. He's worked so hard.
How come his fiancée didn't mention it?
Well, I understand it was to be a sort of surprise. He didn't want her to know about it till it was accepted.
Oh. Well, what kind of book was it, exactly?
It was an expression of his views on the decline of the human race.
And which publisher did he submit it to, any notion?
Bolton House. They deal more in that kind of thing, but he should have heard from them by this.
Maybe he has.
Why hasn't he contacted me? He gave me his word he'd let me know at once so I could be the first to congratulate him.
At the Piccadilly offices of Bolton House, a well-known London publishing firm, Studdy was referred to one James Hibble of the editing staff.
Elliot? Oh, yes, of course. He brought the manuscript in to me himself. Had an introduction from one of my associates.
Oh, and what was the verdict?
Not good, I'm afraid. Oh, it had merit of an obscure kind. But to begin with, it was far from original. At least 50% of his thoughts were directly inspired by the writings of Nicholas Ferrar. Those that weren't came from Swedenborg, Kierkegaard, Shaw, and a dozen others. In one particular spot, a whole passage was taken word for word from Boehmer. No, Mr. Studdy, I'm afraid our young friend, although obviously an ardent consumer of profound works, has little to offer the world. Apart from his borrowing, he's far too destructive, immaturely so, to make his presence felt. You follow?
Well, I get the general idea. Too many gripes and nothing to gripe about.
Exactly. Perhaps in 20 years' time, when he's lived a little more, when his head's a trifle clearer and maturity has clarified his thinking, perhaps then he'll try again.
I take it you rejected the book, eh?
Outright. The manuscript it was returned to him last week.
Yeah, that figures. And you haven't heard from him since, I guess?
No.
Well, I won't take up any more of your time, Mr. Hibble. Thanks a lot. Well, there it is, Chief. Seems fairly obvious what happened. When he got the manuscript back, he whipped himself into a stew and in a fit of temperament burnt all his books.
Certainly seems to be the most likely explanation, Stanley. It still doesn't give any indication of where they might have gone.
Maybe he rushed off to join the Foreign Legion.
Or else recovered his composure and decided...
Yeah?
Well, it occurs to me that a person like Elliot would hardly throw in the towel after one solitary trouncing.
How do you mean?
If you persuaded yourself you were brilliant, you spent 2 years compiling a book... only to have it flatly rejected by the very first publisher you sent it to. Well, what would be your reaction?
Well, I guess I'd be pretty cheesed off, but not being brilliant, I wouldn't know for sure.
You might fly off the handle for a time. After a while, you'd simmer down. You'd convince yourself that publisher number one was a fool. He couldn't recognize genius when he saw it.
So?
So you'd submit it to another publisher. And if it was refused a second time, you'd repeat the process until you'd exhausted every publisher in the business. That is, providing, of course, you hadn't burnt the manuscripts along with your books in the throes of your... initial tantrum.
Hey.
I could be wrong, of course. It's worth following up, isn't it? Now, let Pauline make out a list of every publishing house in London. We'll check with all of them, and if that manuscript has been submitted again, well, one of them must have it. In which case, they ought also to have a record of the author's new address. It was simple enough to obtain a list of the various London publishing firms. And it was just as simple, although somewhat more arduous, to check with each one in turn. This latter task, of course, was Studdy's. And it consisted of 11 separate phone calls, which he made the following morning, working through the list in alphabetical order, until he found himself talking to a certain Irwin Cropton of the Randolph Press, who more than justified his diligence.
Ronald Elliott, you say?
Yeah, that's the name.
What was it you wished to know about him exactly?
Well, first and foremost, whether he submitted a manuscript to you in the past week.
We did receive a manuscript from a writer of that name, yes. As a matter of fact, I have it here on my desk now. But,
well, where can he be contacted? Can you tell me?
Oh, just hold the line a moment. I'll check.
Oh, thanks. Bullseye, Chief. We hit it right in the nose.
Splendid.
I've got the address now.
Hello?
Yeah?
It was written on the cover sheet, 17 Gilbraith Road, Northwest 6.
40 minutes later, Studdy alighted from a cab at the entrance to number 17 Gilbraith Road in the Kilburn area. A lodging house had offered bed and breakfast to all comers. It stood between a butcher's shop and the shell of a bombed-out slum dwelling. At the front door, he was informed by a plumpish woman in an apron that a Mr. Ronald Elliott had taken up residence in the establishment on the previous Thursday, which coincided with his departure from Turnham Green. Accordingly, she directed the agent to a room on the third floor.
Yes? Ronald Elliott?
Yes.
I'd like a word with you. Studdy's the name, Missing Persons Bureau.
He was tall and thin, with a long, sloping forehead and round shoulders which reduced his height by several inches. His hair was ruffled, he was unshaven, and his sunken eyes were red with strain. In silence, he listened as Studdy explained why he'd come and who had sent him. Then he smiled curiously, smoothing out the folds in his grey turtleneck jumper, and replying,
"That's the basic trouble with women, Mr. Studdy. They don't know when they're well off."
Well off or otherwise, Miss McLean's under the impression that you and she are engaged to be married. Furthermore, her bank balance is showing a deficit of nearly £600. Dough she lent to you in preference to putting it towards her trousseau.
She'll get it back in time.
When your book sells, maybe?
Perhaps.
What made you run out on her?
I needed a change of scenery.
You sure it wasn't because you were scared?
Of what?
Of being proved a fake, a bag of wind. Of having her find out you're not quite as brilliant as you painted yourself. You were banking on that book, weren't you? To justify your big talk, you needed something tangible to lean on. And the book was to be it.
Zelda knew nothing about the book.
Maybe not, but you'd have been quick enough to tell her if you'd sold it. Not that there's anything wrong in that. A guy has a right to show off to his girl, to get up on a soapbox and play kingpin, but you did more than that. You had her looking up to you like you were a god of some kind. You laid it on to such an extent, in fact, that you got yourself into a sweat wondering how long it'd take her to wake up to the act. To discover her knight in shining armor was nothing but a mirage, a barrel full of hot air. That his big talk came out of other people's mouths. Well, the ride's over, chum, leave us face it. Your book is exactly what you are. A nobody. A nothing.
Get out of here!
Okay, I'm going. But if that prize intellect of yours is one-tenth as big as you like to pretend it is, you'll stop making like an outsider and come over on the inside for a change. That way, you might one day get to write a book of your own.
Henry Simon returns to conclude this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
Whether Studdy's words had any effect on Ronald Elliott, I couldn't say. For as far as we were concerned, directly our client had been informed of his whereabouts, the case was closed. I very much doubt that words alone could bring him to his senses, however. He was far too steeped in self-deception and conceit. After all, bitter experience is the only cure for such a malady. And even that is by no means infallible. There are some people who will never learn, either from their own mistakes or from the mistakes of others. But they will simply continue blindly along their chosen course, to be swallowed up by the oblivion of their own stupidity. And now, this is Henry Simon, as always, inviting you to meet me here again, and for the present, bidding you not goodbye, but simply au revoir.